Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, December 11th, 2008. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own magazine, fills us in on smoked beers, what styles are best smoky, and how do we get our own beers to have a great smoked flavor. Well, if you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing. That's all one word. The 2009 Brewers Logbooks, still here. And the Introduction to Wine Kits DVDs, they're both here. They're going out. Check out our online store at basicbrewingshop.com to find them. And don't forget to check out our new video podcast. An episode is coming up in the next few days, our second episode, Basic Winemaking Video. You can find that on iTunes and basicwinemaking.com. And I'm still pimping the Amazon thing. If you I'm making hay while the hay making is good. That's not the saying. It's while the sun shines. But anyway, if you're during your Christmas shopping on Amazon.com, please don't forget to click on the Amazon Associate link on basicbrewing.com before doing so. Thanks very much to everybody who's been doing that. We've seen an uptick, as would be predicted this time of year, through that support. And we appreciate that very, very much when you keep us in mind when you're doing your Amazon shopping. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but helps support this podcast. One more note before we go on. For our listeners outside the United States, we've fixed a glitch in our online store that's been preventing you from ordering First Class International. So if you tried to order something on our site and only saw Priority International, that situation has been resolved. So sorry about that. Sorry about any confusion or inconvenience that has caused. This darned internet thing. We're seeing a lot of traffic through the store, and it's fun to see the customer demographics shift from masculine to feminine as we as more wives, I guess, and girlfriends and significant others pick up Christmas gifts for their brewing partners. It's either that or around this time of year, women get just really interested in brewing. More women should be interested in brewing. Doggone it. Let's step into the mailroom before I put my foot in my mouth, talking more about female brewers. If you'll remember last episode, we had a note from Evan in Louisiana who'd been leaving his mash resting all day and then lautering at night in order to spend more time with the kids. Evan said he's been experiencing some smoky flavors unintentionally and was wondering if the extended mash was the reason for that. Well, Brandon from Palmyra, Wisconsin writes, regarding the brewer who had off flavors after an extended mash, I accidentally did the same type of extended mash due to a scheduled meeting that was several hours too long. Holy smokes. This resulted in an accidental 6-hour mash, which was enough time to allow for wild yeast and other bugs to create some off flavors in my blonde ale that seemed to take over, reminiscent of Band-Aid. In order to fix this beer, I blended in a Brett strain, added some more wheat malt, and now consider it a sour blonde ale that is close to Jolly Pumpkin's Oro de Calabaza. Well, there you go. Thanks, Brandon. Another testament to the resourcefulness of homebrewers. If it's a little funky, one way you can go to fix it is to make it even more funky. And we're getting Jolly Pumpkin beers in Northwest Arkansas now, so woohoo to that. Rad from Bozeman, Montana writes, after seeing Steve and me sip on Ricky's Maple Barley Wine on the latest Basic Brewing video, Rad says, I just watched your video podcast featuring a maple barley wine. To reiterate the point, I brewed a maple honey porter that turned out incredible. Maple along with a porter style is a great match. It's almost like breakfast in a bottle. And Rad says, I kid. Well, not really. That sounds like a good breakfast. Steve in Seattle writes in looking for advice. Steve has a better bottle, and he wants to know what other better bottle owners are using for a blow-off tube. Apparently, the opening of the better bottle is way wider than the standard carboy opening, and Steve's standard one-inch blow-off tube doesn't fit, and other solutions that he's seen online only accommodate narrow tubing, which to Steve seems too narrow to be functional. So if you have a better bottle and have successfully accommodated a larger blow-off tube, drop me a line and let me know how you did that, and I'll pass that information on to Steve and share those here as well. Aaron writes in from Lafayette, Louisiana, and starts off by saying, "The first time I watched your video podcast, I thought, who are these old guys?" Thanks a lot, Aaron. He's 21. I used to be 21 a while back. I personally prefer the word or the term well-aged as opposed to old. You know, like a fine barley wine. Anyway, Aaron recovers by saying that he became a fan of the podcast and has a question. Aaron says, "I don't have a lot of money at my disposal, so most of my beers have been session beers, all extract, coming out at under 4% for about $30 with a lot of hops." "I love hops," Aaron says. "I would like to make a big brew and would like to know what is the cheapest way without losing hop bitterness to make a really big beer." Well, Aaron, if you're making a really high-gravity extract beer and want to maximize your hops, one way to do so is to add most of your extract around 15 minutes before the end of the boil. This will allow you to get good hop utilization and bitterness extraction in the lower gravity during the beginning of the boil there and keep most of your extract from darkening. I found that you need to add a little bit of extract in the beginning of the boil to allow the hops to integrate into the wort. Otherwise, they tend to float on top of the plain boiling water. But, and those of you who have listened to this podcast for a while may be able to predict what I'm going to suggest. If you're wanting to make high-gravity beers and not spend a lot of money, you can also do small batches or half batches. If you reduce your volume, you reduce your cost of ingredients, and especially in the case of big barley wines, you're not going to be drinking those at the same rate as a moderate gravity beer, are you? At least I hope not. Also, making smaller batches will allow you to tweak and dial in your recipes without risking a lot of cash on ingredients for a beer that you might not be thrilled with. So when you're happy with the recipe, after making it in small batches, you can scale it up because you're confident with the way that beer will taste. By the way, you can see Steve and me sampling a couple of small batch holiday barley wines in the next episode of Basic Brewing Video. Now, the first one that I opened was flat, and that kind of surprised me. But I figured out after we stopped tape that what I did differently was I racked that batch into a growler after chilling it in the fridge and settling the yeast out. We used that growler on the show last year around holiday season to make fruitcake and wassail. And then I bottled three or four bottles out of that. And now I realize, of course, that what I should have done was to pitch a little fresh yeast into that beer at the time of bottling and priming. So, lesson learned. This year's holiday barley wine was bottled right out of the primary without chilling. So there was plenty of yeast to condition and carbonate the beer, and it looked a lot better, fizzing up and foaming up there on camera. But they both were very, very tasty beers anyway. Thanks, everybody, as always, for the email. You can drop me a line at james@basicbrewing.com or just use the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from, and please don't forget to check your email address. Now let's get on to our discussion with Chris Colby on smoked beers. I have to give a shout-out on this one to everybody who submitted questions through Twitter, because before I interviewed Chris on that morning, I tweeted that I was going to talk to him. And I asked for questions, and you guys came through. Well, Chris Colby, welcome back once again to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you, James.
Smoke 'em if you got 'em. We're going to talk about smoked beers today. It's something that's kind of fond and close to my heart. I haven't had a bunch of smoked beers, but what I've had, I liked. And I've gotten a lot of questions from Twitter. I tweeted out there that we were going to be talking about this, and so I've got a lot of good responses, good questions. And one that we should probably lead off with is from Brett in Lakeville, Minnesota. What are the good commercial examples of smoked beers, and is there a measurement for smokiness, kind of like, you know, we have IBUs for bitterness?
Yeah, that's a good question. Smoked beers are they're relatively rare. There's just not a ton of them out there. The two that most people think of, perhaps when they think of like the classic smoked beers, are the Eicht Schlenkerla Rauch beer. The Schlenkerla Brewery makes a smoked Marsen, they make a smoked Doppelbock, they make it's a smoked Bock, and a smoked Weizenbock that make it to the U.S. here. And then in their brewery in Germany, they make more, a few more styles, and they have, you know, seasonal ones and stuff. And then also Spezial is another German brewer that makes smoked Marzens. And those are smoked beers you can get here in the States, and sometimes if you look around. Likewise, in the U.S., if people smoke beers, or if a commercial brewery smoked beers, a lot of times it's a porter. Alaskan smoked porter is the most famous example. Very hard to find, though, although it's well known. I had tried a beer recently by the Left Hand Brewery called the Goosenator, which was a smoked Doppelbock, which I liked quite a bit. And I know Rogue makes a smoked beer, and they're just, you know, you just have to sort of look. They aren't the most common beer style in the world to find, but there are some out there. And, you know, the best ones, I think, are... I really like the Schlenkerla ones. There's also another German one called Raukenfelser Steinbrau. Just occurred to me. That one's a weird one because it's a smoked stone beer.
Huh.
They heat big chunks of granite and throw it in the wort to boil it. So it's sort of got two weird aspects in its brewing.
I like weird, especially when it comes to beer. So
then the second part of that question was units.
Oh, yeah.
And no, there's no, at least when you buy malt, it doesn't come with any sort of rating as to smokiness. I know that there are ways that maltsters can and do. They measure some of the phenolic compounds of smoke and how much that gets into the malt as an internal quality control thing. But I don't think they report them. And even if they did, those things tend to be kind of volatile. And, you know, it would be a snapshot of what the malt was in the past.
Yeah, I guess it would be handy kind of to have some kind of a smokiness indicator so that you could look at the side of the bottle. And if you liked a little bit of smoke in your beer but not overpowering, you know, if there was some sort of a meter or a measure like IBUs that you could use to do that. I guess smoked beers aren't as common, you know, as hoppy beers, so there's probably not that much demand for a smokiness measurement industry-wide.
Right. There, you know, there's only the handful of examples. And, I mean, the basic... I don't know, the way to look at it, if you get the Schlenkerla beers, those are very smoky, very, very smoky. Things like Spezial and Raukenfelser Steinbrew are much less so. Of the Alaskan porters I've had, those are fairly smoky, although those were older examples when I tried them.
Mm-hmm.
The Goosenator, when I had it, was nicely smoky, like a sort of like Schlenkerla style. Beyond that, I'm thinking that I've only had, brew pub examples beyond that, so I can't really think. But yeah, there's no, yeah, the malt, it doesn't come rated in smokiness units, and the beer itself doesn't, there's no, you know, SUs, smoke units, or anything associated with it.
But that's a good question.
And it'd be nice if there was, but.
Nathan in Iraq says, I am in Iraq for the next year, and the great folks at Left Hand have agreed to send me a couple of bottles of Smoke Jumper Imperial Porter in care of my mother-in-law for me to enjoy when I return next fall. I've heard numerous opinions about cellaring with respect to alcohol content and temperature conditions. With a high alcohol beer like this porter, should I ask my mother-in-law to store it in the fridge for me, or do you think that a cool back closet would suffice? I would estimate that the closet would stay around 70 degrees max, even though it's in northeast Texas. So we especially want to answer this question from Nathan. It's not necessarily about simply smoked beers, but if you were going to be out of the country for, a year, and we certainly wish Nathan well and everybody who's serving our country, especially during this time of year, our thoughts go out to you guys. But is there a special handling technique for these smoked beers?
For smoked beers, if you've got a smoked Imperial Porter, you've got a couple things to consider aging-wise. Actually, I'd say three. It's high alcohol, it's got dark malts in it, and it's got smoke in it, all of which are going to, I would think, contribute to its ageability. Aging in beer is a really almost completely undefined subject right now. It's hard to say. And even in wine, which people have aged for, centuries, they still really don't know what's going on in there, and there's even less known about beer. But my advice would be to put it in the fridge. Beer is, even big beers are meant to be served fresh, although with larger beers, the meaning of fresh sort of moves down the road a little bit. But I think at 70 degrees, I would think the beer would just get torn up pretty quick. If you had somewhere to store it at like 50 degrees, that would be different. But I would say just put it in the fridge. It's certainly not going to do it it's not going to be any worse for wear due to putting it in the fridge. You're not going to like hamper any positive aging that would occur. And I think it would just, you'd have a better shot of having a decent beer when you get back. If you did that.
Yeah, this is a situation where since it is such a treasured beer, you definitely want to take the best care possible. So don't take any chances and stick it in the fridge.
Smoke has been used as a preservative for centuries. Smoked fish, one of the reasons they smoked fish back in the day was that it was a preservative. It basically coated the fish with the phenolic-y compounds of smoke, which have a preservative quality. They're also low in pH, and people smoked fish and meats and different things as a preservative. So I would suspect that this beer would have a good shot at aging pretty well, although the components in smoke are also very volatile, so they go away and degrade kind of quickly. So it might not. It, in fact, almost probably certainly won't be as smoky as the day you brew, or as the day they brewed it. But it should still be a really nice beer.
Yeah, along those same lines, Craig from Brew Bubba's and Craft Beer Locator says, "How long do smoky notes last, and are these beers made for laying down?"
Smokiness decreases over time. The components of smoke, I think I said volatile, that's not quite correct. They're just reactive, I guess would be a better word. So you make a smoked beer, and it's going to be, when it first gets ready, it's going to be as smoky as it's ever going to be, and then it's going to fade over time. I know some breweries like Alaska, they store bottles of their beer, and they do verticals, and sometimes they report the notes of the tasting, and I guess it can be interesting to see how something like that evolves. But for me, when I've brewed smoked beers, it was a beer that I was going to drink, fairly quickly, because I knew that, the level of smoke that I'd added to it, if I liked that level, that wasn't going to be there for a while. you know, this, I think it's also a little bit of a, you know, it's just a sort of a personal question to, you know, some people brew beers more to try to, you know, make ageable beers. And certainly I think adding smoke is going to be potentially a component that makes a beer potentially more ageable. But, you know, I think, at least for whatever it's worth, I tend to brew my smoked beers as just regular old, you know, everyday beers, and I drink them when they're fresh.
When we went to Great American Beer Festival a few years ago, the Alaskan Brewery had a vertical tasting. They had, you know, library or archived examples of their beers from years past, and it was interesting to see how the smoke evolved over time. And I think that they had like even numbered years, like the, you know, the present year, and then 2 years before, and then 2 years before. And it was interesting to see how the smoke evolved over time. In the older beers, the smoke was still present, but it wasn't nearly as sort of harsh as the fresher beers. So it would be a tricky question if you only had one bottle of a smoked beer of a certain year, when to drink it. But if you had your own batch of smoked beer, it would be an interesting experiment to, over time, taste, you know, taste bottles of it, and then save some in the cellar to see how it evolved over a period of time. So it's a tricky question. You know, if you've got this beer in the bottle and you can't taste it through the glass, I mean, you know, when's it going to be at the peak of goodness? It's a tricky question.
Yeah, if you got a single bottle of anything, yeah, you're just rolling the dice about when to drink it. And I, you know, I usually think fresher is better in beer. But yeah, I haven't gone to an Alaskan Brewery sponsored vertical, but I've tasted a few older bottles of in a row of smoked porter once, and it was interesting just to see how the changes developed. But on the other hand, well, it was interesting, and as a brewer, I could, you know, go, oh, this is nice, because, you know, the other flavors too in beer, you know, they'll decline over time too, hoppiness and stuff. It was still, you know, you very definitely knew you were drinking old beer. You could it didn't taste fresh, and you know, to me it was interesting as a brewer, but I kept thinking I would have rather drank this when it was fresh and tasting good. But then again, I mean that is also a personal choice. Some people, you know, almost like the taste of old beers, especially older, you know, heavy beers.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a matter of preference. So let's talk about making smoked beers. What styles are appropriate for adding smoke?
Well, you can add smoke to anything you want, really, but most people, either if they're going to brew at home, use the commercial examples as a style and go for, you know, like a Märzen or an Oktoberfest base or a porter base. But you could do whatever you want, really. I mean, I would say there are, you know, styles, if they have a lot of hop flavor or aroma to them, that might not be the best. But certainly any malty style can be good. I've had excellent smoked Scottish ales. I would avoid it in a sour beer. I don't think that would be at all good. But yeah, I think there's a lot of room for experimentation, you know, just because, you know, smoked porter and smoked Märzen right now are the most two common, doesn't mean that they're the only, you know, the only style that can work in.
Yeah, we did a blending show with Michael Tonsmeyer, and I have a sour smoked porter that I'm aging in my basement. And the smokiness is pretty subtle, but it kind of pairs well with the level of sourness that I've got. And we blended that beer with a beer that was more sour and – or more smoky, I'm sorry. And they were saying that the guys that tasted it were saying that the smokiness, the increased smokiness, clashed with the sourness. So there is a balance there.
Interesting. Yeah, I never had a smoked sour beer before. It just didn't you know, the two flavors didn't sound like it'd be good. And I'm trying to think. I can't think of any sour foods that normally come smoked either. Mm. That's sometimes a good guide if you're thinking about formulating a beer from, you know, flavors or aromas that maybe don't normally appear in beer. If you think of, like, what do they appear in food, you can sometimes get a good, you know, or somewhat good feel on how that's going to work out in beer.
That's a good point. I'll send you one, see what you think.
Sure. I'll drink your beer.
That sounds like a bumper sticker as well. I'll drink your beer.
I'll drink your beer.
The most popular question was from David in Savannah, Georgia, Rick Sellers of Pacific Brew News and Draft Magazine, and Pete in Pittsburgh. They all had questions along the same line. Peat versus wood-smoked malts, what are the flavor differences, and what about, you know, how do you gauge the amounts of each of those in recipes? So I guess we start talking about getting smoke into your beer by using commercial smoked malts.
Sure, and there are sort of two different categories. There are commercially available smoked malt. There are peat smoked malts, and there are smoked malts, or, you know, that have been smoked over hardwood. And peat smoked wood, you know, peat is like it's decomposed like moss and lichens that have been sitting in an acidic bog for a long time.
Mm.
And yeah, acidic decomposed lichens.
Pardon me, I got to get a napkin. My mouth's watering.
Right. Yeah, crazy tangent here. My dad's family used to be peat. Is it farmers, miners? I don't know what it was. they still have their bog, and they go and cut peat from it and sell it to garden supply stores.
Oh,
so it's weird. And they've got somewhere in the family photos, they've got this great old photo of some engineering genius decided to make a railroad line through the peat bog. And there's this picture of a train, like, laying on its side, slowly sinking into a peat bog because it's like, you know, it's like a sponge, essentially.
Yeah. Well, you need to have them send you some family peat so you can smoke that and or burn that and smoke your own peat smoke malts.
I'd just throw it in my garden. I wouldn't bother with peat smoke malt. Yeah, the thing to know about peat smoked malt, though, is it's mainly used in whiskey production. It's not, at least commercially, it's not used, or at least not very often, in the smoked beer production. Or I guess a better word, not traditionally used. Nowadays, a lot of American brewers, they'll use it. And peat smoked malt usually comes in two sort of strengths. There's a lightly smoked and a heavily smoked. From a homebrew standpoint, though, both of these are very, very smoky. Usually, if you're brewing 5 gallons of beer, you know, a couple ounces of either of these is going to be more than enough. The other kind of smoked malt, just German Rauchmalts, which the only example I know of is Weyermann's. They make a Weyermann Rauchmalts. Rauch is just smoke in German. And that's smoked over beechwood. Beechwood is a very, very hard wood. It's used a lot for smoking because it burns at a consistent rate and sort of ironically doesn't throw off a lot of smoke. So you can control the amount of smoke that it gives off by controlling the combustion, you know, how much air the fire's getting. And that's the one that is used to make the traditional sort of smoked Oktoberfest, smoked box, and stuff like that. And this is compared to peat smoked malt, the level of smokiness in Rauch malts is like an order of magnitude or two lower, you know, like at least tenfold lower than peat smoked malt. With Weyermann Rauch malts, you can use it's a base malt, so you can use 100% of it as your grist, and I've actually used almost 100%. I've used that and maybe a half a pound of Crystal 60 or Kira Munich, you know, whatever, and made, you know, an Oktoberfest style smoked beer, and that'll do really good. It'll be really smoky if it's, but it's not off the charts smoky.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was a smoke bomb, you know, like you have hop bombs. Are there, is it so smoky that it offends people, or is it, you know, still fairly moderate at that level?
Well, I wouldn't call it moderate at that level, but it's the sort of thing, if you like smoked beers, it's nice. It would be on par, or maybe just slightly smokier than the Schlenkerla commercial beers. And it's funny. I judge at contests, I like a lot of weird styles that other people don't. Like, I actually like sour beers, and I like smoked beers. And so, yeah, I usually ask for those categories, and it's usually pretty easy to get there. You know, get seated at that judge table because, you know, nobody wants it. And so I've judged at a lot of contests, and I've judged the smoked beers. And I was at I forget if it was at the Dixie Cup or at the HA first round of nationals, but one year somebody had a smoked wee heavy where they took Weyermann Rauch malts, and then they smoked that malt themselves over oak. So they were smoking an already smoked malt, and then they made 100% of their grist, if I remember right, and made it into a wee heavy. And that was I liked it. That actually won the flight, although I thought it was I thought there was a couple other beers in the flight, but that's not here or there. But it certainly turned the heads of the judges and was a really good beer. So, yeah, you can, I guess what I'm getting at is you can dial the level of smoke up pretty high. And if you fundamentally like, you know, especially if you like smoked foods at all, you know, you're gonna enjoy smoked beers, and you can make a significantly smoky beer and still have it be palatable.
So you can be a smokehead as well as a hophead.
You could.
So before we get away from peat entirely, is there a flavor difference between, in addition to the amount that you would use in the recipe, the strength, is there a flavor difference between peat and wood? I mean, could you tell if the smokiness were balanced between two beers, which was a peat and which was a smoked malt?
Yeah, you easily
wood
could. The Weyermann Rauch malts is smoked on beech. I just said that 2 seconds ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was here.
I just like blanked on it all of a sudden. I was thinking alder, because most Alaskan porter uses alder wood.
Mm-hmm.
Weyermann Rauch malts is beech malt. And that in the Weyermann beers, which are very smoky, lends almost sort of a bacony, nice smokiness to it. Yeah, peat malts have a lot more of an edge, are a lot harsher malt, even when the level of smoke is balanced. It can be nice when it's the smoke is standing up to something else. Like I've had some peat smoked porters. Stone makes one, actually, and in this issue we actually clone it, and that can be okay, especially in lower amounts of smoke, like in the Stone recipe. But for bigger, smokier beers, I think it's just too, and again, this is another personal, you know, some people might like it, but I just think the Rauch malts is a lot better if you want a heavily smoked beer.
Mm.
or smoke your own on your, you know, your home grill or home smoker.
Yeah. Well, I guess I've never had a peat or a beer made with the peat smoked malts, but the wood smoked malts that beers that I've had remind me of either bacon or, in the case of the Alaskan smoked porter, maybe more salmon. You know, so they would definitely they remind me of smoked meats, and they would definitely go well with smoked meats.
Yeah, a lot of times the flavor of the smoke will remind you of the food that it's most associated with. Like if you've ever had a hickory smoked beer, hickory, you know, ham and bacon. Mm-hmm. So you frequently think ham and bacon. Like alder is the wood they frequently use to smoke salmon. In fact, the Alaskan brewery, you know, they smoke their malt at a salmon fishery,
mm-hmm.
or salmon smokery or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, with when you smoke with hardwoods, a lot of the flavor recognition to you can be somewhat tied into what your experience has been with that smoke in food.
We alluded to it a little bit, but you can smoke your own. We have questions from Homebrew Chef in Sonoma, California, and my buddy Jack from Las Vegas. You know, can you smoke your own? And can you use different woods, like, for instance, cherry?
Yeah, it's terrifically easy to smoke your own, and it can be a lot of fun, too. You can do, if you have a grill at home, if you have a barbecue, if you have a smoker, any of those things will work. I've got a Weber grill, and how I do it is, I just take the grill. I went to like Home Depot and got screen door material, and just cut out a screen that fit over the entire top grill portion, just so that to retain the grain. And what you do is you make a little fire or whatever. I usually, if I'm going to be smoking malt, I'll grill something for dinner or whatever, and then come back and smoke the malt afterwards, because you sort of want the coals to burn, and then you want it to sort of start settling down and start cooling down a little bit before you smoke the malt, because you'd like it. The lower the heat you do it at, the less you're going to be sort of cooking the malt, and especially if you do a base malt. You don't want that, you know, because you don't want the extra color. You don't want the extra, you know, you don't want the degradation of the diastatic power of the malt. And so, you know, let it cool down. And then I take wood chips that I've soaked at least a couple hours. Hopefully I thought about it ahead of time and soaked them overnight. Take some wood chips, put them in like heavy duty aluminum foil, like make a pouch, and then just poke a few holes in the pouch. The idea is you've got sort of wet wood in there with not very much oxygen, and the wood is going to sort of combust very slowly and inefficiently, and that makes, you know, smoke. Whereas if you didn't wet the wood and just threw it right on the coals, it's just going to burn. It's going to burn fairly cleanly, and, you know, in addition to the excess heat, you're not really going to get the smoke you want. So throw the tin foil pouch on the coals. Let it start smoking, and I usually sit around and just sort of wait until, sometimes I think the first smoke that comes off smells kind of awful, so I just sort of wait till it smells like, hey, there's a good, you know, smokiness, because I've used hickory chips mainly in the past, and, you know, and so when it gets a good smelling like hickory smoke, put the grill on, put the little grate I've got over it made from a screen door material. And then what you do is you want to smoke the malt. Basically how you do it is you wet the malt and then you smoke it again until it's dry. And the idea is that there's water on the outside. The smoke will mix in with that water, and then when the malt dries, it sticks to the outside. So the trick is you want to wet the malt just enough that at the end of your smoking, it's done. So in other words, for a short amount of time, you just very lightly wet the malt. Like you can just take a spray bottle, and what I usually do is spread it out on the screen door material before I put it on the grill, and just sort of spray it down with the spray bottle of water, and turn the malt over a couple times and spray it. In that way, you can also, because if your spray bottle has graduations on the outside, you know how much water you've added. And then I usually smoke for a fairly short time. But you can just wet your malt, like just dunk it in water and let it sit for a few hours and take in quite a bit of water, and then you can smoke for an extensive amount of time. Yeah, you'd need to have, if you did on a home smoker or a grill like this, you'd need Well, home smoker, you just keep plugged in, and that, so that would go continually. On a charcoal grill, you would need to have like a second grill going with a like a reserve thing of coals, and you know, stick in a new hot coal or two every once in a while to keep it going. But yeah, you can smoke for a short or a long period of time. A lot of recipes and the way a lot of home brewers do it is to smoke their crystal malt. So you're going to want to go, you know, for a while at least, because, you know, you're not going with 100% of the grain bill. But you can just definitely scale it to whatever you want to do. And a couple notes on finishing it off. When you get done, sort of ideally you'd like to pull it off when it's just short of being dry. Then stick it on a flat cookie sheet in the oven, and on very, very low heat, you know, like under 150, if you can imagine, or if you can manage that, you know, turn the oven on low and have the door open. And because basically when smoke burns, there are some things that it gives off, like actually gives off formaldehyde and acetic acid, which sort of don't have really pleasant flavors, at least in beer. But they're also very volatile, and just a little heat will sort of condition them away. And then a lot of people, I suspect for similar reasons, you know, will pour all their smoke malt once it's done and dried in a paper bag or something breathable, not a plastic Ziploc, but like, you know, like a paper grocery bag or whatever, and just let it sit for a couple of weeks before they use it.
Uh-huh.
And it just sort of acclimates. And yeah, once you've got that, as long as the key thing is you really need to make sure you've dried it. You can't, you know, don't soak the malt overnight and then, you know, smoke it for a half hour and then, you know, expect that it's going to be good in 2 weeks because, you know, it'll get moldy. And one thing you can do if you really, really want to make sure that it's dry, like let's say you're making, if you have like a big barbecue and you're really making a lot of malt that you're going to, you know, use over time, you can, if you're careful that you don't lose any and drop any, you can wet the malt and then weigh it before you put it on the grill. And, well, actually, you got to weigh it before you wet it, weigh it after you wet it, and then, you know, as you smoke it, and when you think you're done, weigh it again. And it should be, you know, when it's wet, the weight will go up, and when it's dry, the weight should go back down to the original weight.
Now, when you're soaking base malts and then putting them over heat, do you have to be concerned about any enzymatic action that goes on in there?
I'm sure some goes on. If you took a base malt and, you know, instead of just lightly wetting the outside, if you say submerged it in water for 3 or 4 hours and then, you know, did like a 5 or 6 hour smoke, you probably would get some, you know, the grain would be wet. It would be, you know, heated, perhaps up to, you know, ideally you'd want the temperature to be right around 100 degrees or a little bit lower. But in practice, that can be kind of hard. So you might be, you know, smoking it right at 150 degrees and it's wet, and then yeah, you would get some. It would turn some of that starch into sugar inside the grain.
So in that case, would you want to, like, do a percentage of your home-smoked malt to make sure that you get the proper conversion in the mash tun?
Yeah, if I was smoking base malt, I would want some regular malt in there just as an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were really good at it and have built up some experience and are able to smoke the malt very, you know, at cool levels and not for, you know, long enough times that it damages your diastatic power, you can certainly just mash and keep mashing until, you know, an iodine test shows that, you know, all the starch is gone. But I don't know, if I were to do it, I'd probably just grab some 6-row and add it because, you know, it's got a lot of enzymes in it and just add a percentage of that and have it be, you know, just an insurance policy.
Todd from Tiffin, Ohio says, besides smoked malts, what are other methods for getting smoke into a beer?
None, really. I mean, they sell liquid smoke, at barbecue places, but if you ever tasted it, I don't think you'd want that in your beer. At least the ones that I've had were all had or seen were vinegar based. So for one thing, you don't want to be pouring vinegar in your beer. So I don't know of any other way to do it. It's funny, when I first tasted a smoked beer, and I mentioned this in the article, I had no idea how they did it, and I sort of at the time, because I had no idea of anything about why bubbling oxygen through beer would be bad, but I thought they bubbled smoke through the beer. That's how I thought they did it. And but obviously that's not how they do it. But I don't know of any other ways to get good smoked flavor in your beer other than using smoked malt.
Well, which leads us to our last question. Gathering Brews from Vermont says, did an ale with 2 ounces of smoked oak chips that aged way too strong? Is there a good ratio or measure for amounts? So it sounds like from that question that he actually put smoked oak chips into the fermenter.
Oh, really?
Well, that's what I said. And I don't have the original tweet, but it said, did an ale with 2 ounces of smoked oak chips that aged way too strong. So that to me, and maybe I'm wrong, it sounds like he used oak chips in the beer that were smoked.
Hmm. Well, I guess then my previous answer was all wrong. You can add smoked oak chips and get way too strong beer. The question of how much smoked anything to add to a beer is always a big question mark because, like I said, the smoked malts aren't rated on their, how smoky they are. And, of course, neither if you buy wood chips or if you make your own wood chips or if you make your own malt, you don't know how smoky it is either until you've tried it. So, I mean, smoke is a lot like a lot of spices where you sort of need to get some sort of feel of how smoky they are or how spicy they are before you add them.
Mm-hmm.
And, so for like how much wood chips to add to 5 gallons of beer, it really sort of critically depends on how smoky is that wood. And there's no, that I know of, no standard, level of smokiness that you would use that with.
But so, is there a reason that you can think of that you wouldn't want to use that method?
In a non-sour beer, I would always be a little nervous about adding wood, even smoked wood. I mean, you would think that the smoking would have some preservative qualities. And what style of beer did he say? It was like a heavy alcohol one, right?
He didn't say. Did an ale.
Okay.
So that's pretty.
Yeah, in a higher alcohol beer, I might worry less about it, but. Just adding wood straight to the fermenter that's the way I make sour beers. So I would, or one of the things that happens during the production of sour beers, not exactly how I make them, but, I wouldn't go that route, but that's not to say that it couldn't work. One thing I would just, whether you're brewing smoked beers or spiced beers, one thing I always think of is it's always best to try to get some gauge of how strong that the spice or the smoke you are working with. And it's always better to underdo it than overdo it. Because usually you can, certainly in the example of spices, you can, take a little extract and boost it up if you need to. And with smoke, you couldn't really do that. But you could certainly, if you were close, and you took good notes, you could certainly brew the recipe again, go, slightly over your target and then blend the two together and make a smoked beer that's right on.
It's kind of like adding salt to a food recipe, a cooking recipe. You can always put more in, but you can't take it out once
right.
It's in there.
Exactly. And this is, smoking is one of the techniques in brewing where it would be nice if homebrewers brewed more and had some beer on hand for blending, you know, because I don't know for sure, but I would guess that a lot of these commercial smoke brewers, they must do some blending, because or else they have some real good way of measuring the smoke character in their beers. Because at home, I know I've brewed any number of beers from almost the same recipe, you know, using Weyermann rock malts, and sometimes it's, you know, big and smoky, and sometimes it's more subdued, and then there's always you're always rolling the dice a little bit when you brew a smoked malt or a smoked beer. And then that's doubly true if you smoked your own malt, because you depending on how you know, thoroughly it is, you know, it can be almost non-existent, or it can be just knocking your socks off.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get some idea by just pour some hot water into a glass, dump, you know, some of your malt in there, and come back a while later and sort of strain it out and just try it as, you know, a little bit of a tea. Mm-hmm. And that'll give you a really sort of quick and dirty first approximation of how smoky it is. And you also need to consider that during fermentation, the level of smokiness is going to go down a little bit, you know, actually fairly noticeably if you taste your wort and taste the final beer. And I'm not sure if yeast take in the smoke, actually, or if it sticks to the outside of their cells or what, but your wort's always going to taste a little bit actually, it's usually significantly smokier than the final beer.
Mm. Well, excellent. It's making me want, as usually happens when we talk about certain styles or methods of brewing, it makes me want to do it. So, or do it again.
I haven't brewed one in a couple of years, and I'm definitely thinking I want to do that now. And, after writing the article.
Yeah, and there's
remembering.
There's, it's a good article. There's step-by-step instructions in there and recipes.
Mm-hmm.
So give that a look. And thanks to everybody who tweeted questions in. And I'm definitely going to use that technique again, because it sure makes my job a lot easier. Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it again. Look forward to next time, next year.
Thanks for having me on, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris Colby. You can read his story in the current edition of Brew Your Own magazine. If you'd like a free copy of BYO, click on the ad on basicbrewing.com and they'll send you one. If you decide to subscribe after reading that, then you'll be helping to support this podcast as well. Remember, everybody, we've got the Brewer's Logbook and our new Basic Winemaking Introduction to Wine Kits DVD out there on our online store. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewingshop.com, as well as our Introduction to Extract Homebrewing DVD and our Stepping into All Grain DVD as well. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com as well. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've got shirts, different colors, and we've got new pictures out there on the gallery if you haven't visited lately. Some more shots from around the world, and we appreciate everybody who sent those in. A lot of fun. And thanks also to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there, especially during this holiday season. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are: the name of this book is Secret. Be that way. And Intermediate Bluegrass Jamming. Wish I could play bluegrass. I like bluegrass. Can't play a note. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. We've also got an associate link to the Apple Store on the site. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.